Hello, welcome to the Gambling Files podcast, RTFM. This is the longer, deeper dive episode where we look at the fascinating subjects going on in the gambling industry today, yesterday, years ago. RTFM, of course, stands for Read the Fucking Manual. My name is John Bruford. I'm one of your hosts. I'm joined by, I was going to call him Abel Deputy, but I used Abel last week and we all know I was lying. Fintan Costello.
Thank you very much, John. And I think Abel is definitely a stretch for me this week. It's been a big week.
I hear you. And I hear you about stretching, but that's a talk for offline. So we're joined today by Max Frooms. Max is an author and co-author with Sujit Indap of a book called, and it's got a great title, and I'm going to read the whole thing. The Caesar's Palace Coup, How a Billionaire Brawl Over the Famous Casino Exposed the Power and Greed of Wall Street. I wonder what that's about. One of the interesting things we're going to talk to Max about today is, Max, I feel your pain being a co-author, as a co-host of this podcast.
It's tough to work with people.
It is. In fact, I said it to somebody in a shop today. Everything in life is fine until you involve other people. How was co-authoring for you? Did it suck?
I couldn't agree more. I definitely think that it's difficult when there's competing visions. But in this case, I think that both Sujit and I contributed something unique to the task, and we're fortunate to be able to work together, and we're pretty happy with the product.
Did you hear that and take it on board, Fintan?
I was reading between the lines there. Max sounds furious to me. I'm not convinced he was happy at all working with Sujit. I think it's all coming out now.
I couldn't say nicer things about Sujit. And it was a wonderful experience for me. And that's coming from someone who's had, difficult work experiences in the past. This journey to write this book was really great for both of us. Took us to Las Vegas, took us to all these different boardrooms of hedge funds in New York and Los Angeles. To private jet hangars over in North Carolina, private car rides around the hedge fund mansions of Greenwich. So it was a real adventure, and I'm really happy that I was able to do it with Sujit.
However, I think it's fair to point out Sujit isn't here.
That's right. I could say anything I wanted.
You really can.
So, because what it made me think of was like those university projects where you get put into a random group and it's a complete kind of lottery pick of, do you have the motivated group? Do you have the guys who just don't care or whatever? So did the working styles gel together? Like how did you guys
I suppose, right? You guys have like the different types of contributions that you have where, John's got all the charisma and Fintan might have all the technical capabilities. And I don't know, something like that, where for us,
he's just read my soul.
Sujit was a former investment banker and he had worked in this world. He's a Wharton grad, an incredibly, sophisticated, financial mind with that, that type of pedigree that I think opens doors for others in the business world, turned journalist at the FT, right? I mean, he saw the light and he wanted to do something more meaningful with his life. And I don't really know, but whatever the case, he changed careers, got this great writing and reporting gig at the FT and has become, I think, one of the better journalists delving into the intersection of corporate finance and corporate law. And if you read the stuff that he does for the FT, It really, and people he knows what he's talking about and he can't get spun like a lot of other journalists. I'm a journalist by background, but my focus has often been technical journalism. So I came from having really gotten an inside view of the distressed debt investing world because I co-founded a newsletter company that focused specifically on the minute distressed debt and corporate restructuring for an audience of hedge funds and investment bankers and lawyers. So I've been really reporting on stuff that was super inside baseball, and we followed every single docket item that came. And as a company filed for bankruptcy, there's this whole system where if a big corporation files for bankruptcy, all the documents are public, but you have to pay 10 cents page and you have to go into this really convoluted system to look it up. And there's, thousands and thousands of pages. So it's not very efficient and it's not completely accessible, but for our little news outlet, we streamlined that and we hired bankruptcy attorneys and financial analysts and just put out this really, really technical news to cover what I thought were incredibly interesting stories. But for me, as a journalist, I always wanted to take a step back and tell like a good story. And I thought that this world had so many good stories in it because the narrative value of transformation and restructuring is just it's inherent. There's Radio Shack and like every single American airline, right, has filed for bankruptcy at one point in time, maybe with the exception of Southwest. Hostess, Lehman Brothers, Enron, like all of these things went through the Chapter 11 process, and spat out a ton of really interesting, fascinating information. I was covering that real time and Caesars over kind of the tenure that I was at this startup, before I sold my shares and went on to do other things. Caesars was by far the most interesting and contentious of those deals.
And I think what's really interesting, so if we kind of flip to Caesars then and kind of look at the, as you described it earlier on, it was a leverage buyout that went horribly wrong. But when you look at all the companies and the people involved, it was very hard. Or actually the question for you is, did you find... did you get to become sympathetic to their struggles? Because it's these kind of distressed debt guys, it's the Predator's Ball, it's the Barbarians at the Gate. This is normally what books about these guys are titled. And it was a lot of what was fascinating for me was just how one or two sentences in a massive document could change everything. So how did your relationship with the protagonists in the story develop or change over the course of writing the book?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question because I think one of our reviews, it was essentially concluded, I don't sympathize with anybody. Nobody comes off as looking like a hero here. They're all greedy. And I think that's right. Ultimately there is tension between the creditors of Caesars and the private equity firms. And, in our book, there's kind of this moral overlay in the form of an independent examiner. And it's this very interesting character where you look at it in terms of before Caesars was forced to file for bankruptcy or filed for bankruptcy, there were a lot of transactions that the creditors were just outraged about that they thought that the private equity firms were moving assets away from them. They were saying that they were stealing the money that they felt belonged to them. And they challenged that in bankruptcy. They got an independent examiner to report on it. And so it was kind of like he was a former Watergate prosecutor by the name of Richard Davis, who had pretty impeccable credentials. And it was kind of like this Bob Mueller type investigation where everyone was waiting, like, okay, well, what's he going to find? What's he going to find? And when he, you know, when his report was released, like literally on, you know, in the Ides of March in 2016, it was damning for, you know, for the private equity firms, Apollo and TPG, especially Apollo. And he found, you know, both, you know, regular and intentional fraudulent conveyance, which is, you know, it's a term for fraud in bankruptcy. Like they were moving assets away and doing transactions that they knew, you know, according to what he was saying, they knew what wasn't giving back a reasonably equivalent value to the entity where all the debt stood. And so they would have been liable to the tune of $5 billion. I mean, like that's a lot of money, and that's a lot of potential wrongdoing. And it forced them to settle, and it ultimately forced them to give up all of the money that they put in at the beginning of the buyout in 2008, which is, you know, was actually for a $30 billion buyout. They only put in about $1.6 billion each, but they had to lose all that money. And that was like a big thing for the creditors.
Sure.
And there are other stakeholders at interest here that we'd wanted to bring in. So we talk about the employees, we talk about the pensioners, and that's what does get lost in sometimes the battle of the titans like this. So I think, you know, our book does mainly focus on these very, you know, well-moneyed and like aggressive investment firms. But we did want to kind of tell the whole story where it talks about a lot of different stakeholders.
Yeah, of course. And obviously, like the employees and the people relying on the pension funds and stuff, they're definitely the victims here in a lot of cases. And because, you know, private equity guys and distressed debt guys, it's, you know, they're going to do what they're going to do. It's like the story of the scorpion. You know, they're going to sting you. Like, that's just what they do. But what I thought was fascinating was how enabled they were from a corporate governance perspective. So like the independent directors and people like that who were, you know, there to look after shareholders or think of the wider implications of things. They seemed very compliant when a lot of this was going on. Is that a fair assessment?
I think that's right. I think that and it's, you know, it's really interesting if you look at the lessons that are learned from this case as well, where, you know, some of the biggest problems that they had with the transactions that the private equity owners performed prior to the bankruptcy was that there were no independent directors that were keeping the creditors fiduciary. I guess they were being responsible for, you know, what was the creditors' well-being. So, but, you know, ultimately they were beholden to the private equity firms and a lot of people that they did business with. And, you know, the lessons learned has been not, okay, well, you know what, we should be a little bit more conscientious about how we go about these restructurings so that nobody loses out. The lessons learned have been, you know, you got to put in the right directors sooner. And, you know, there's even been a study that's done about like the super repeater where there's independent directors that come in, they're very well known and they have connections to, you know, either the law firms that works with private equity firms, the private equity firms themselves. And they come into a lot of these restructurings as, you know, so-called independent directors to approve of the, you know, different transactions that a company is trying to do to maybe stave off a restructuring or prepare for negotiations. And it doesn't, you know, and oftentimes they're not keeping, the employees or, you know, the pensions or kind of the smaller, less powerful stakeholders in mind. Absolutely. Mm.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think what was really interesting, so there was a couple of underlying trends as well over this time period. So one was the total rewards, and I think we'll talk about that in a sec. But the other one, what I thought was really interesting was the trends, because John knows far more about Vegas than I do. But it was the transition period from you know, we make all our money from, like, Las Vegas making all its money from gambling, from to Las Vegas becoming an entertainment destination. So I love the fact that Britney Spears shows up in the book as kind of a key moment, right?
Oh, it's a one. It is. It, I thought it was, that was like just one of these kind of wonderful like pieces of information that were just snuck into this 1800 page examiner's report, you know, and the story of that was Apollo and TPG. They bought this because they thought that they were going to be able to purchase other casinos and kind of plug that into this total reward system to get people to come and do gambling, but you know, also all these other promotions and shows and like make it a family event. So they're building all these things and they're looking at these different acquisitions and ultimately acquire Planet Hollywood. They want to cut a deal for a Celine Dion type residency, and they want to get a real, you know, real big star to come to these residencies that are just huge money makers because they bring in people from all over. You know, they make money off the concerts, they make money off of people staying in the hotels, and they make money off of, you know, them gambling. So these are huge draws. And the meantime, they can't make their interest payments. They're like coming close to not being able to make their interest payments on, you know, like the main operating company. And so in order to raise some cash, they have Planet Hollywood at the main operating company. And they're going to transfer, that and a couple of other properties into another entity that is remote from all this debt, and then give them some sort of consideration. And they have investment banks come in and do the valuation of what is this worth. And they come up with these valuations with like at the same time that they have just signed Britney Spears to a major residency. And it's called Project Songbird. And, you know, that's like, you know, there's a person who had gone to become a Google exec that an advocate for it. And you know, it's like a big get for them. They think it's going to be super valuable. But during the valuation of it, they don't actually give it too much more consideration. They're like, oh, yeah, you know, we don't have to use any projections for Britney's success or whatever we're going to get from that wonderful, or, you know, her huge fan base or whatever. And so they wind up giving it very little value, and they don't give as much consideration as ultimately the creditors thought they should have, or that came out in the examiner's report. And then Britney went on to have like one of the most successful residencies in the history of Las Vegas. Right. And that it was like, don't undervalue Britney here as part of this big story. It was pretty interesting.
That's fantastic. And then there was also like you touched on kind of the acquisition of Planet Hollywood, which I think was done at a very good price. But then there was other acquisitions like Playtika, the mobile, the social casino product.
And this was a great thread as well. So Playtika was an acquisition of an Israeli gaming company, basically online kind of Boom Beach, Candy Crush type of mobile games. Mm-hmm. That Caesars was able to do with a Canadian lawyer and entrepreneur by the name of Mitch Garber. They did a lot of pretty interesting entrepreneurship within Caesars. And this was like, you know, this turned out to be kind of their saving grace. And they first hired Mitch Garber on because he set up some online gaming businesses up in Canada, and they want him to do the same thing in the US. And so they keep on pushing for the US to legalize online gaming. And, they come up against a huge opponent of them in Sheldon Adelson, and among others. And they just can't get it done. They can't get online gaming to be legalized. And to this day, it's not fully legalized. It's only legal in a couple of states. So at the time it was like, do we give up or do we kind of pivot? And Mitch Garber decides, you know what? let's see what we can do by leveraging the poker tournament, the World Series of Poker, with just mobile gaming, right? We see all these mobile games that are being super successful. They go out and they pay $100 million for Playtika, and have them just build out pure mobile, like mobile online gaming with the World Series of Poker brand. And with, you know, without it being even real gambling, that winds up being a huge success. And it is part of the, it is one of the assets that has been moved away from the operating company where all the debt is and supposedly wouldn't support all of that debt. But it doesn't actually become, you know, it's not known that it's that valuable until it's like the late stage of the bankruptcy. And the two sides are so far apart. They wind up shopping it around and then getting a group of Chinese investors to buy it for $4 billion. So you had the creditors, you know, basically the creditors on one side whose debt has been just decimated. It was worth 10 cents on the dollar at one point. And then you have the private equity firms and the company on the other side saying, look, we'll pay you 20 cents to go away. And they're like, no. 30 cents, no, 40 cents, no, 50, 60. You know, and they just kept on saying no, and they couldn't bridge the gap. All of a sudden, they get $4 billion out of nowhere, and they're like, all right, you know what, 66 cents. And that actually solved the bankruptcy. They might still be fighting over it, you know, today if they didn't have that huge sale. And now it's like public. I think it's worth like $10 billion. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's huge. It's huge. And it's, you know, like if you look at, say, Zynga, which is probably a comparable product, like the Texas Hold'em product for Zynga has basically propped Zynga up forever.
Huh. Yeah, interesting.
So it still blows my mind that people do play money gambling with real money. It's utterly bizarre. So the other one then is the total rewards is kind of a key product, and I know you've described the revolutionary marketing genius behind total rewards. I think what blew, and I had to kind of go look up some dates and stuff. So this was all around like when the total, as was my point is, what you described around the total rewards system to me seemed super basic. And for the time period it was in, like there was plenty of other industries doing very similar stuff or even more advanced stuff. Was it just, you know, the casino industry was just that far behind, or did I miss something?
The total reward system had been, you know, hadn't actually been implemented until the early 2000s, right? Like, so, you know, this was something where Gary Loveman was an MIT professor turned, an MIT PhD turned Harvard Business School professor. And he had been doing some training for like the Harrah's companies, which kind of like cold promise companies in the 1990s. At that time it was like the mathematization of the data that was coming in from various businesses had only really been done in the credit card and the airline industries, right? And so it had not been applied to gaming business. And it really was Loveman who introduced the type of reward system that, you know, was only a burgeoning one in like the airline and the credit card industries into the gaming universe. So that it really was kind of revolutionary, and he did it in a way where it took advantage of all of this rich set of data that people give to these casinos as they go in there, right? Like if you just, they started tracking everything that they did, and they gave people these cards that would say, you know, like, oh, okay, you sat and you played at this type of game, you spent this long, you, you know, you stayed in this hotel, you bought these types of things. You know, that was a big data project that had not been taken advantage of until in the gaming industry, until Loveman stepped in. So that gave them a huge advantage over their competitors. And yeah, everyone did scramble to catch up, and it's since become pretty standard. But at the time that he was, he was implementing it for Harrah's, and then kind of taking over Las Vegas. There's a good book by a former Wall Street Journal reporter called Winner Take All that kind of describes, like the competition between a bunch of like big, big ego kind of guys like Steve Wynn, and Sheldon Adelson and others. And then you have like, the propeller heads, they called them, like Loveman and PhDs, and the PhDs started winning. So, at the time, it really was a revolutionary approach to taking advantage of all the data in gaming. And now I think it's become pretty standard.
Got it. So you had that kind of old school shoot from the hip. I do my retention and CRM based on gut feel versus, hey, we've got all this information and we can slice and dice things pretty thinly to... Mm-hmm. Give the blackjack players who like to come in midweek a particular offer versus the VIPs who come in on the weekend a different offer and these kind of things.
The old school way of doing it. It was like the incredible box, like the spectacle, like the fountain, the volcano, the resort, the suites, the spectacle, the white tigers, that type of stuff had just been, it was just people trying to outdo themselves with spectacle in Las Vegas. And they all were doing some very, obviously they started bringing in MBAs and things like that, but it wasn't really kind of until Loveman and his group of PhD level mathematicians that came in to take the promotions to a different level.
Got it. And I think that there's probably parallels to the online space in the US right now as well, where there's huge marketing budgets, there's huge focus on acquisition, but then there's a few brands I think that are actually really focusing on the data and the conversion rates and the retention rates. And it's not just a grow at any cost type scenario. Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. It's just interesting to see kind of the same mistakes repeat themselves in different ways.
And it's, and the interesting thing about it ultimately, once you get that, you get to towards the time of the bankruptcy when, Caesars filed for bankruptcy in 2015, early 2015. By that time, it became obvious that the engine for growth, the total rewards, like the Genius marketing and promotion system, was not sufficient for a management team that needed to retrench and manage liabilities. Like all they knew how to do was grow at all costs, and there was just a lot of stuff that had been ignored or swept to the side, and including what is still kind of, it's like this push and pull between, okay, you have these regional operators that know their market and you want to let them kind of lead, versus the hub and spoke system where there's just this brain trust at the hub telling everyone else what to do based on maths, right? There needs to be some sort of combination of that. And, there needs to be some type of restraint on the amount of money spent on these types of promotions and R&D. And, it was such a rocket ship that they had no constraints, and they didn't know what to do when they all of a sudden had to start slashing their budget and cutting, selling off casinos and doing layoffs. It was, it was very trying on a management team that wasn't used to that. And it became very apparent that, that wasn't, Loveman's skill set. So that was one of the reasons that he was replaced as CEO right in the middle of this whole thing. And now it's kind of it's just still there's interesting tensions between those types of skill sets. You could be the one to grow a business, but you might not be the one to, you know, manage a mature business or to deal with any sort of retrenchment or hiccups.
Sure. As they put it in The Godfather, there's the wartime conciliary and the peacetime conciliary. And
there you go.
They're two very different people.
Totally.
You need to be more Sicilian.
Yeah.
Okay. I love it. What else haven't we covered?
That's a good question, Fintan.
Finally. Thanks, John.
I have two small things that I'd like to raise. One was earlier, and I am going back quite a long way here, but you referred to Sujit, your co-author, as an investment banker. I just wanted to clarify.
Recovering investment banker.
Yeah. I just wanted to clarify for English and Australian listeners, that's not rhyming slang, is it? He actually worked in an investment bank.
He did, yes. Lazard.
Okay, just checking. And
some places before that too.
Have you thrown all the useless information out of your head, or are you still keeping up with, you know, transactions and trade on the Las Vegas Strip? Because it's been a pretty interesting few months, I think, with the MGM getting the operating license for Cosmopolitan, Blackstone selling it, Blackstone also being part of the group that's buying it. I really did chuckle when I read that. With MGM saying, I think it was yesterday, for the record, we are recording this on Friday the 5th of November. I think I just dated the recording, saying that they're open to selling the Mirage as well, for example. Maybe I'm wrong about this, but the complexion of the Strip seems to have changed with the introduction and the possibility of an REIT.
Oh, yeah. Well, so it's, yeah, I mean, that Caesars is part of that universe, in that the solution to the bankruptcy was to split Caesars into an operating company and a property company that was formed as a REIT. Now, there's some restrictions around this now that weren't in place then, and Caesars got grandfathered in. But essentially, the REIT gets tax breaks that other companies don't. So they put more debt on it, and it's a little bit more valuable as they split it off from Caesars, and they gave the REIT to their lenders, like their first lien lenders, and some other lenders got the majority and controlling equity stakes in a company that is now called Vici, V-I-C-I. And so they own all this real estate that, you know, Caesars operates casinos in, is how that works. And those two companies still exist side by side. Caesars, subsequent to emerging from bankruptcy in late 2017, went on to be acquired by a more regional operator by the name of Eldorado. Much to the disappointment of the disciples of Loveman and others, right? They felt like it was kind of a rebuke to their whole growth model. But it wound up being incredibly successful for anybody who got equity from the bankruptcy or who bought into the Caesars equity after it emerged. And I don't know, it's some huge multiple of what it used to be. And the irony there is that Apollo, even though it lost all of its initial equity check in Caesars, they had put some more money into this separate company where they were putting the valuable assets that were later challenged. They were able to keep that money, so they owned a portion of Caesars when it emerged, and ultimately Carl Icahn came in and didn't like their CEO, thought that Caesars was being was just being undervalued and could potentially be an acquisition target, and so they needed to squeeze out this other CEO, and Apollo needed to get off the board. So Apollo did. They wound up selling their last little vestige of their equity stake at a time when, you know, part of which they allegedly or reportedly sold to Carl Icahn, for a fraction of what it's worth today. So Apollo just did everything wrong in Caesars. Don't let that deter them, because now the news is Apollo's come back in, and they have purchased, with the help of Vici, alongside Vici, which is the real estate investment trust, the Venetian from to see Sheldon Adelson's company, and are going to be back in the Las Vegas Strip. So that has yet to go through, and there are some people on the Nevada Gaming Control Board who have received our book that I've heard and may ask some tough questions to Apollo when coming to approve that acquisition. But it's probably going to go through. So Apollo is going to be back there. Blackstone has, a history in Las Vegas with their, wildly profitable acquisition of Hilton Hotels.
Does anybody else here think that Blackstone sounds like a villain in a late 80s straight to video science fiction film?
Yeah, I mean, I can see it. I can definitely see it, right?
If some, whoever named that company is sitting there rubbing their hands together and saying, sorry. So anyway, you were saying Blackstone, big money, made some.
Oh, they did. Yeah. And they've been in Las Vegas for quite some time. So they're coming back in, and they're the ones that are looking to acquiring the Cosmopolitan. But they did well by putting more money into Hilton, negotiating with creditors, and then seeing that come back at the same time that Caesars had been suffering. It's not a complete apples to apples comparison, because Caesars had some other things that they missed. They had their business in Atlantic City become decimated and were impacted in a way that Hilton wasn't. But that was a sharp contrast that Blackstone wound up making something like $10 billion off of Hilton. Whereas Apollo just did nothing but sink money into Caesars.
And you know, now they're back, and I think we can all find cause to celebrate.
Like Las Vegas is back. That was one of the interesting things reporting this book, was that people that knew like the gambling industry, and there's a lot of hedge funds that were in the debt, that their underlying thesis was, all right, you know what? There's going to be a lot of games played between Apollo and these other creditors, and there's going to be a lot of things that go on here. But no matter what, we know gambling's coming back. We know that Caesars is going to come back. We know that Las Vegas is going to be coming back. And so they just bought across the capital structure. So they bought all different types, tranches of the debt, knowing that it was undervalued compared with where the company would ultimately be worth. And those, a lot of those hedge funds made a lot of money.
Well, it's impossible to argue. I mean, the only thing counting against even against Caesars at that point was, I mean, the real estate was incredibly valuable, hence the success and popularity of the REIT with the creditors. I think at one point it was like 20 million an acre or something on the strip. They own the best part of half of it. It was never going to be a really bad investment, because even going to auction, that property was always going to make a shit ton of money. But, and you touched on this earlier on, Caesars never had any interests in Asia, whereas MGM and Wynn were both at different times propped up by their operations in Asia doing so fantastically well. And Las Vegas Sands was very, very much supported by its Asian enterprises. And Caesars never had that you know, a shit day in Vegas for Caesars was just a shit day for the company overall, mm-hmm. pretty much. Whereas MGM and Wynn and Sands could afford to ride out tough times a little more easily.
It was, you know, it was a huge miss, admittedly so. And they
left them very vulnerable, though, didn't it?
They were interested in it, and they did actually try to get a license. They ultimately turned down a deal. I think it was to kind of like purchase this area next to, you know, Sheldon Adelson's Macau Wynn, or maybe it was Singapore. But there was a deal that they had been working on that they just turned down. That was, they thought it was too overvalued, and they wound up being completely wrong. So they looked at it and they just whiffed. They totally whiffed on that. I mean, you know, they have a ton of casinos just like around the country too. So New Orleans was one of their most profitable properties. Like, they did have a couple in Illinois, and that's how they ultimately filed in Chicago. And again, Atlantic City was a third of their profit at one point. So they, when like Las Vegas was always coming back and it was going to be okay. But it was really that vulnerability in Atlantic City that hit them hard, combined with the complete whiff in Asia.
Well, they might have learned from it I think they're in with one of the integrated resorts in Japan now. I think they've learned that lesson.
Mm-hmm. Okay. There is an interesting thing right now over in Macau, where Macau has just announced that they are kind of like looking at their gambling regulation in a way that they actually might change things up on casinos such as, such as Wynn and MGM.
Well, the license review keeps getting put back, doesn't it?
There you go. Yeah. So it's not clear that they're going to be able to renew their license, or if there's going to be some additional difficulties put in place. And I think that was one of the concerns that Caesars had about Asia. They missed out on a half decade of incredible profits.
Well, if you look at how much Wynn and Sands, actually, and MGM have all poured into that since Caesars didn't take up that option.
Yeah.
Wynn Palace has only been open a couple of years, mm-hmm. And it's been extraordinary for them. They basically invested X billions into Wynn Palace without knowing anything about the license. You know, the license review is still just, we're just going to review your licenses in a few years. Yeah, by all means, invest $8 billion.
we're following that. I still lead a news team that covers corporate debt, and we're following that because Wynn and Wynn Macau have a lot of corporate debt, high yield bonds outstanding.
Mm. Yeah, it's very interesting watching companies that have a high level of corporate debt, and Fintan and I were talking before we started recording about Scientific Games. I don't know if they've ever been on your radar, Max. Mm-hmm. But they've really surprised me this last month with the sure-footed and very, very quick movement to refocus the business. As soon as I saw that they were selling the lottery arm, I'm like, hang on a second, something doesn't ring right here, because they've just renewed an absolute shitload of lottery licenses and won new licenses. The lottery arm's going great guns. It's underpinning most of the company, and it's keeping the wolf from the door.
Oh, interesting.
But if you sell it, you can wipe out the company's debt in one go. Plus, they've invested in a company called Authentic Gaming, and essentially they've repositioned the company in a month. And I think what they've done is amazing, really bold, really brave, and I'm super, super impressed. And I never thought I'd say that. And I'm not dissing them when I say that. But when a company reaches that sort of size, when you're in the 5, 6, 7, 8 billion revenue bracket, you don't tend to be a quick mover. You don't tend to address things swiftly. I mean, maybe it's been bubbling under for 3 or 4 years, but the acquisition they've made, I think, is a very canny one. It opens up massive new lines of business for them in a country where online gaming is opening up, and they've very obviously seen where the future is. They're going to wipe out their debt in a stroke. It's gravy from here. Or is it?
Yeah. I know that Scientific Games has, at various times had a lot of corporate debt as well, but they've been able to manage it, and it does speak to the growing popularity of gambling.
I think it's going to be big.
Yeah. I think that's it's been the case that they can. They can get a lot of corporate debt, and in some ways it's like it might be more higher price than others right now because of ESG issues. But ultimately there's a belief in gaming and an understanding that it's always going to be very popular that props these huge capital structures up.
Super. Fintan, have my incisive questions ignited any new fires in your brain?
No, it just always reminds me of how little I actually know about Las Vegas.
Well, it's like...
I'm such an online nerd. That's what it shows me.
Well, it's why we work well as co-hosts, Fintan, as I think Max has already established for us. And Max, thank you for being our counselor today.
Oh, we've got a lot to talk about after this.
Yeah, let's unpack this for a while. Where does the hostility come from?
He's just so good at his job. It just makes me feel insecure. I can't help it.
I'm just good at sounding like I know things. It's not the same as actually knowing things. People that actually know things write books with titles like The Caesar's Palace Coup, How a Billionaire Brawl Over the Famous Casino Exposed the Power and Greed of Wall Street.
It's a good point. That's
available
a very
on
good
Amazon.
Point. Available on Amazon and all good bookstores.
Absolutely. And probably some bad ones.
Whatever you got to do to make the New York Times bestseller list, right?
Yeah, I'm expecting just a huge uptick in sales after this podcast.
Oh, absolutely.
Tens. Well, I say tens.
Well, I bought one.
for the day. That's all it takes for the Amazon ranking to be juiced a little bit. So that'll be great.
We can arrange.
So if anybody's listening, if you wouldn't mind, thank you. Max, thank you for joining us. Much appreciated.
This has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much, John, Finn.
Brilliant. Thanks, Max.